Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our Tenneo Insights call. It all seemed to be going so well. The summer was relaxed, restrictions were easing, we were eating out to help out. But just a few weeks later, the nights are drawing in as autumn takes hold, infection rates are rising, predictions for the economy are getting worse. Areas that are facing the most severe restrictions are complaining bitterly. Fundamental questions seem unresolved. Why is the UK experiencing turmoil that other countries don't seem to be? It's undeniable that the UK underestimated the impact of coronavirus in the short term, and we've been playing catch up ever since. Given that, do we need a circuit breaker of another national lockdown for a few weeks, pressing reset, or will that just delay the inevitable, compound confusion, and do more damage? Should we be learning to live with COVID? Is it naive to think a vaccine when it comes will solve all our problems? Is the cure worse than the disease? Have the scientists and medics looked at this through too narrow a window? It's certainly true the impact of the lockdown and restrictions on young people, mental health, domestic violence, and cancer testing have been extreme. And that's before you get to whole sectors of the economy being devastated. I could go on, but I know you want to hear from our another amazing panel. Sir Andrew Whitty is a World Health Organization envoy and former CEO of GlaxoSmithKline. He's perfectly placed to talk about strategies to tackle COVID-19 and the impact on business. Amber Rudd is a regular to these panels. She can help us make sense of what's going on politically at the moment. Dr. Richard Horton is Editor-in-Chief of The Lancet. He'll help us understand why countries like Germany have far fewer cases and deaths per million. And Professor Sean Griffiths is Emeritus Professor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong and has huge experience in public health issues. Before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the sidebar of the screen, you can see the Q&A function. Please send your questions here and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say that if there are any journalists on this call, please can you hang up now? This isn't intended for outside broadcast or publication. Andrew Whitty, I'm going to start with you first. With your role at the WHO, particularly on COVID, and having run a major business, you're perfectly placed to give us some insights on what's going on. Tell us what they are.
Oh, great. Thanks very much. Good morning, everybody. Obviously, the last 6, 7, 8 months has been dominated by the emergence and then the varying reactions to the COVID virus. What we've seen across the world are some really diverse outcomes. So countries which had early virus, often in Asia, reacted extremely aggressively in terms of their test, trace, isolate strategy, and appear to have been able to substantially limit the spread of the virus into the broader population. Other countries, as you move further west, have had a more varied response to that. And as you rightly say, in the UK, clearly we've been through a first wave. We're now into a kind of continuation or strengthening of the virus presence. I'm not sure talking about waves is necessarily super helpful here. This virus is around and it seems to just take advantage of its environment at different times. The situation we're seeing in the UK is not unique to the UK. The US is probably the best analogy, if you will, or comparator. Very similar kinds of dynamics playing out in the United States and some other Western European countries. What's going on in terms of response, I think, is pretty inspiring, actually. If you look at the mobilization of global efforts here, whether that be some countries, some governments, and I would say the UK, particularly in the field of stimulating vaccine development, has been a strong leader. US similarly. If you look at many of the agencies, the Gates Foundation, Wellcome, Global Fund, Gavi, CEPI, all of these organizations have really started to mobilize very substantially. And we're in a position now where in the last 6, 7 months, the first of potential treatments have started to emerge. Dexamethasone was the first identified in a UK VAC study to help treat patients who already have the disease at a particular stage of that disease. We've seen now 9 vaccines at least go into full-scale clinical development. It doesn't mean that we're going to have a vaccine next week, but it means that our chances of having a vaccine sometime next year are better than you would have expected a year ago. And we've also started to see the rapid emergence of much more useful diagnostic tests. So rapid diagnostic tests allowing people to see results very quickly and allowing much more mass use. and also at much lower prices. So WHO have just secured 120 million of those RDTs for about $4 or $5 a test. That compares to $25, $30 a test for PCR. So, you know, that's a big difference in terms of giving people access. And then the final thing I would say, Craig, is we are seeing unparalleled cooperation across a whole number of actors across the world. So in my WHO assignment, I'm privileged to chair something called the ACT Accelerator. That basically stands for Access to COVID Tools Accelerator. That actually comprises the European Union, it comprises a number of countries, it comprises the Gates Foundation, WHO, Global Fund, UNITAID. It's an unparalleled coming together of almost all of the major global health agencies and some countries and others to try and mobilize a comprehensive response to diagnostic, to treatment and to vaccine. So a lot going on, but we are still in the relatively early days of this virus. That probably isn't a very inspiring statement for most people on this call, but you know, we are still in the beginning of this thing. I would say that good news is a lot of mobilization. It's a bit patchy. Different countries are focused on slightly different things, but there are the seeds of things to be optimistic about.
Okay, well, we'll discuss those a bit later. But Amber, look, the news is coming thick and fast this morning. It seems to be all political around COVID-19 in the UK with what's going on in Manchester, Liverpool, London, Wales. Help us to try and understand what's going on in the politics of the situation at the moment.
Thank you, Craig. And great to hear some glimmers of optimism from Andrew, because otherwise, on the political response, things are not looking optimistic, as different leaders from different parts of the UK representing either different areas of government or councils are beginning to really stamp their foot, as are Conservative members of Parliament, who are getting a lot of kickback from their constituents saying, what on earth is going on? How can you support this? It's very difficult to describe this as anything except confusion. And where there is confusion, there will be political manoeuvring. And that's what we're seeing at the moment. I don't want to derogate, really, the people who are leading on this, like the mayors and the leaders of the devolved nations, because they are genuinely just taking a different view. And at the core of it seems to me that there is one main issue, which is our test, track and trace working? And everybody is concluding that it's not. And in Andrew's earlier comments, he described to us how some countries like China, like Vietnam, like South Korea seem to have got through this much better. And the unifying issue there seems to be that they have effective test, track and trace working. And the fact that ours is not means that as soon as it pops up again, it's not the virus, we're not able to put it back in the box. And so instead, we get this wave of regional lockdowns, which as they come in stronger and stronger in different parts of the country, are beginning to look like a national lockdown. And today, of course, we've heard that London has entered tier two, which means that there is no meeting of households, no meeting of households in restaurants or in pubs or in bars. And that will mean, you know, devastation really for the hospitality centre. But there is, of course, again, this political kickback, which is, oh, you care now it's London. You didn't care when it was us in Newcastle or Manchester or whatever it is. And so the mayors are beginning to have a big impact as well. So it feels to me like the government's in another place where it was at the start of the lockdown in March, where it's having real trouble gripping and putting some templates in place which allow people to have confidence in the line that the government's taking. I mean, when I talk to MPs, a lot of them are tearing their hair out, not at the actual policy, but the fact that the policy changes so much and seems to be illogical in some elements. Why is it that we can do this, but not that, or that and not this? That's what really winds people up. And it feels like there is issue upon issue piling on at the moment, and the government is struggling to hold its authority around it. I felt that the last one really was about the consultants, which is this latest sort of scandal, really, where it turns out that the government has been paying consultants from the Boston Consulting Group a lot of money, which averages out at £7,500 a day, some of them, which WAGS have pointed out is in 1 week more than a nurse's salary, which is making people doubly uncomfortable. I don't think they would mind if it was a successful test, track and trace system, but since it's not, that is just adding to the problems. So the government's in a very difficult position now, not just because of the actual response to COVID, but because different parts of the country are responding differently and making different demands. And I have to say, I don't think either that they're taking advantage of some of the good things that the government is doing. You know, to finish on a positive note, just as Andrew did, actually, the response to the lockdown areas, which is to give people two-thirds of the salary that they had and to add on universal credit where needed, is a perfectly reasonable response. But instead, we had this morning Louise Casey, who's very well known, very well respected, as an authority on poverty and on gangs and extremism, in fact, going on the radio and broadcast media saying, what do you mean by two thirds? What are people supposed to do for the other third? How are they going to get their money? And the answer is they can go and get it from universal credit. But nobody was out there saying that. It was a perfectly reasonable response to support families of all sort. So I think this is a very difficult time for the government, where people are getting increasingly dissatisfied, not just with the lack of communication, but with the lack of empathy with people as well.
Thank you, Amber. Richard, as editor-in-chief of The Lancet, you're across all aspects of this, but help us on what's going on in the UK. Is it because we've just failed to get test, track and trace right that we're having so many problems? And why are other countries like Germany apparently doing so much better than us?
Well, thanks, Craig. Yeah, I mean, I think the question we might all be asking this morning is, surely there is a better way. Back in March, I think we did all agree that lockdown was the only reasonable response to a virus that we really barely understood. Patients filling our intensive care units, there was nothing else to do except close down society. But now we're seeing scientists disagreeing, politicians disagreeing this week about the best way forward. The Great Barrington Declaration, you will have seen in the last couple of weeks, was very strongly anti-lockdown, supported by some scientists recommending focused protection for the most vulnerable people in society. You may have seen the letter in the Times last weekend arguing that people should be free to take the risk of catching the virus. We should be putting more emphasis on individual responsibility rather than governments taking responsibility. Last night, we published a response to the Great Barrington Declaration called the John Snow Memorandum, which argued that that view was a dangerous fallacy, and that if you had uncontrolled transmission in society, then that would lead to significant morbidity and mortality that would eventually overwhelm the National Health Service, but also damage the economy. So who's right? You know, back in January, we published five research papers that described this coronavirus, COVID-19, and the severity of the illness. So my view tends to be shaped by those experiences of people working on the front line of the NHS and science, those who are managing the pandemic. And I look at this as a doctor, as a scientist. I don't claim to have any special insights about policy, but the facts, I think, are pretty clear. We're seeing the incidence of COVID-19 increasing across the country in all age groups. It's moving from local hotspots to a generalized epidemic. R is greater than 1 in most local authorities now. The infection is out of control. It's doubling every 7 to 14 days. Intensive care units are filling up. TTI isn't working. The turnaround times are worsening. The contact tracing is suboptimal. We know this week we published a report of an American in Nevada who got reinfected with the virus. So we know that getting infected does not guarantee immunity. Then we have the issue of long COVID. 90% of our population are still susceptible to infection. And we also know that the burden of this virus falls on the frailest in our society, the poorest, and Black, Asian, and minority ethnic communities. So my God, you know, knowing all of that, what do you do? So although it's right to say that scientists advise and ministers decide, the consequences of not acting, and this was Sage's view, are so severe, everything's so urgent, that the case for some sort of circuit breaker seems, at least to me, unarguable. It's short-term pain, absolutely, but for long-term gain. because it will buy us time to keep the prevalence of the virus low in our societies and communities and to fix the test, trace, isolate system. Now, some of you are going to say, hang on a minute, why can't we be like Sweden? But Sweden is a really bad example to compare us with. The death rate in Sweden is about the same as the UK. In the UK, it's 65 deaths per 100,000. In Sweden, it's 58 deaths per 100,000. It's not much different. Sweden isn't going to be some magic solution. We should be saying, hang on, why is Germany, in Germany, the death rate is 11 per 100,000. In Japan, it's 1 per 100,000. In South Korea, it's 1 per 100,000. And we're 65. Why can't we be like Germany, Japan, and South Korea? And the answer to that is that those countries succeeded because they did suppress the virus, and they did that through really good test, trace, isolate systems. Their population stuck to the rules. They adhered to the advice about wearing masks, physical distancing, social mixing, and very, very importantly, self-isolation. There was trust between the public and government. There was solidarity amongst the public, and there was also great leadership. And the UK's leadership, sorry to say, has been a disaster. We, in the middle of a pandemic, we abolished Public Health England. We created the Joint Biosecurity Centre. We had to create from scratch NHS Test and Trace. Who's in charge? Is it COBRA? Is it the Joint Biosecurity Gold Committee? Is it SAGE? Is it the Chief Medical Officer? Is it Boris Johnson? I have no idea, and I don't think you do. So it's a mess. But I am super optimistic. I'm going to end like Andrew and Amber did. And why am I optimistic? Because of history. After every epidemic or pandemic, societies always bounce back. Lessons are learned, and national revival is possible. So I think we've got every reason to think that if we can keep this virus out of our communities, we can protect health, we can protect the NHS, we can protect the economy, and we can save our way of life. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. That was excellent. Sean, I saw you nodding quite a lot during all of that. You've got huge experience of what goes on. You're just on mute, by the way. You've got huge experience both in Asia and in the UK. Can you just give us your reflections on that? Oh, you put yourself back on mute.
Yeah, I'm off. Okay. It's always difficult to follow Richard because I agree with so much of what he's just said. So rather than reiterate it, I just reflect back on the SARS epidemic in Hong Kong, because I think it demonstrates how you can, as Richard says, you can learn. You can learn from history, even short-term history, not necessarily back to the 1918 epidemic. I got involved in the SARS epidemic because I was asked to chair the Hong Kong government SARS inquiry in 2003. And one of the points I'd make is that we're not learning the lessons here in the UK in the way we should be. Richard pointed to the demise of Public Health England, which I was going to point to, and I want to come back to that later. But let's go back to 2000. But we go to Hong Kong, and it's a pretty toxic environment because the GDP had fallen. And this is the link between health and wealth. I think people took SARS seriously once they realized it was impacting in the longer term on their economic position. The position we took in the inquiry was that we weren't going to blame, we were going to look forward and say, how would you do things better next time round? And to cut a very long story short, we came up with messages around communication, about engagement of the public, about capacity, about the surge capacity, about academics working together. All those issues were very important. I think that in terms of has Hong Kong learnt this time round? The answer is yes, it would appear Hong Kong has learnt this time round. Because this time round, as soon as the cases in Wuhan were announced, right back in January, the Hong Kong government started to take measures about quarantine, effective quarantine, closing the borders. There was some debate within Hong Kong about whether the government acted quickly enough and closed down most of the borders, but they had to sort of adjust it. So it's not done without political questioning and not altogether a smooth ride, but they closed the borders. They put in place very strict entry requirements into the country. Everybody, and I underline everybody, has to have a test going into the country. If you're positive, you have to go into the hospital system, you go into the hospital sector. If you're traveling with that person, you go into a quarantine hotel. And if you're negative, you go home and you're followed. You're absolutely followed with a bracelet and with regular phone calls. Now, I use the illustration of the borders and serious implementation of quarantine and the way it was implemented very quickly, because it enabled the track and trace system to stay on top of the outbreak. And they've seen four spikes. They now got another spike in Hong Kong at the current time, but they know who it is. They can trace, they can say, is this an imported case? Which it often is. Is this imported? Is this a local case? How has it been spread? How do we actually break the chain of transmission? And so far that's been effective. So I think I give that as an example of where it's very important to be on top of the disease. And it feels a lot of the time now in the UK, it's felt for a long time, we're not really using track and trace effectively and properly. And until we are not going to be able to use the non-pharmaceutical interventions, which are necessary before we get to the use of the vaccine and greater levels of immunity in the population. So Hong Kong, Korea, Japan, all the countries in the East that have acted very quickly, they've put in place quarantine, they've got good test and trace mechanisms, they have closed down environments, they respond to the epidemiology. And they've done it by, I think, the population understanding. The communication with the population has been clear and consistent. In Hong Kong, they have had daily briefings throughout the whole of the pandemic. There is a map you can go, if you go onto the Health Protection website, you can see exactly where the cases are. You can estimate your risk. You can be engaged in the decision making. And that's Hong Kong, that's part of China. And it is actually really quite remarkable how that side of the world has managed to stay on top of the disease, just as it's very impressive how New Zealand, Australia have managed through, again, taking it very seriously, the government acting very quickly, very decisively in the early days. So we come to where we are now, and I don't need to rehearse either what Amber or Richard have been saying about the fact that we are now in a very tricky position with the politicians having to decide which science to follow, how to actually get the balance between the harms of lockdown, the social harms, the mental harms, not just the economic harms, and of course the fear of the spread of disease, just as Richard has been describing. And I think there are no easy answers, except that we do need some consistency, we need engagement, and we particularly need engagement at a local level. If you take the way that the Directors of Public Health were not engaged right in the early days, they were the ones who knew how to contract trace at local levels. They were not engaged, that they had to fight to become engaged in the response. And it is really essential that we have local public health engaged in the response at a local level, able to help to make the decisions. Just in Oxfordshire, where I live, they've just implemented their own contact tracing system because they don't rely on the national system anymore. So I think there's some really difficult issues here that need to be dealt with, but we need to trust local people, trust the local public health system, and invest in local response, because without investment, they cannot continue to actually combat the disease. However, I did want to finish. I see many issues in trying to get on top of this at the current time, many practical issues from a public health perspective. But Richard made the point in his offline in The Lancet this week, and I'm going to go back to that because I thought it was really, it was very uplifting, because what he did is he did make that point he's made today about we learn from epidemics, we get through epidemics, we come out of epidemics, and we could have a better society at the end of the day. What did we learn from the initial lockdown? We learned about collectivity. We learned it was nice to work from home. And I put it like that because actually many people said in The Economist said you can't work from home, and look at us now, we're all sitting here talking to each other just as if we were more or less at home. It is important. You can do things about mental health. You can do things about improving the way that we live our lives in the future. So there will be some changes. And very importantly, we've shown what happens if you close down lots of the causes of pollution. I mean, look at China's blue sky. Unfortunately, it's starting to get grey again, but many of us have learned more about the planet through the lockdown. So optimistically, maybe we can take some of these lessons away with us as we move into the future.
Thank you, Sian. That was great. I'm just going to point people again to the Q&A function, which is on the sidebar. There's already some questions coming in thick and fast. But I'm going to start, because there was quite a lot of agreement on the panel, by trying to put what some other people would say was the opposing case. A lot of people, particularly the sort of libertarian area of the Conservative Party, say that this has just gone too far. The scientists and doctors have looked at this through too narrow a window. If you look at the facts, the average age of somebody who dies with COVID, not necessarily of COVID, in the UK is 82.4. We are doing incalculable damage to the prospects of young people. There are massive issues on mental health. This week, 3 million people, it would emerge, have not been tested for cancer. And who knows how many of those people will actually have it as a result of it. And what they're saying is not necessarily, yes, we may have got the test, track and trace wrong, but just seeing it through the narrow prism of what is the best thing to do medically and scientifically is not necessarily the right thing to do for the whole of society. So Andrew, you were a businessman as well as having, you know, your World Health Organization hat on. What would you say to people who argued that case?
Well, listen, I have a lot of sympathy with that conundrum, and I think everybody, you know, this is not an easy black and white set of choices. But I think the reality is we are where we are, and you can't dream of starting from some place where you're not. We're in the middle of a pandemic. We have significant disease present in the population, and you know, I'd agree with Richard, there's very little evidence to suggest that if we're not assertive around trying to control it right now, we will have a kind of explosive period of the pandemic, and the NHS won't be seeing anybody except COVID cases. I mean, it'll be so. I'm completely frustrated and empathetic with the question around what about everybody who doesn't have COVID, of course. But the reality is, we're now at a point where I think we have almost no choice but to continue to bear down on slowing this pandemic, trying to take the heat out of the winter period, because otherwise, you know, you can see in some of the hospitals just the rapid, you know, acquisition of COVID cases that's going on at this point. And very quickly, we're going to see that overwhelm things. So I think practically speaking, you know, we need to do a much better job of not, we talk a lot about test and trace. The thing we often shy away from in the UK, which is not the case in the countries that Sian was talking about, is isolate. There's actually not much point testing and tracing if you then let people wander around and give it to everybody else. So I'll give you an example. If you fly into Australia right now, everybody on your aircraft will be bused to a hotel, not of your choice, of the government's choice. You will be sequestrated in that hotel for 2 weeks. You will not be allowed to leave your room, and people and the government will essentially supply food to you. Now that is isolation. Now we don't do that kind of thing, right? We just really don't. You know, I've known people who've come in through Heathrow. They don't even get asked a question. They just come straight through Heathrow. So just little examples like that. I just want to emphasize the isolate. And now that in itself is a hugely political choice, right? I mean, I completely understand all the libertarian issues associated with that. But that is a key element of all of this. The second part, I think, is realistically, we have got to accept we have an infectious disease circulating in the population. And to the degree to which we can create separate infectious disease hospitals and facilities, separate from places which try to carry on as normal, and which I know the government are trying to do, but we didn't really do that very well in the first wave. The first wave, this thing got into everywhere kind of got bogged down almost simultaneously. The nightingales came on stream just really as things were starting to peak and drop off. We've got to be really aggressive around how we use this excess capacity, really have centers which are as best as possible streaming the COVID cases. And then we have to work super hard to bring forward best medical practice, and this is, you know, the kind of thing the Lancet brings to life, we have to be learning how to treat these cases as best as possible to drive down mortality rates as quickly as possible. And there is huge amounts of learning going on around the world. You look at the use of ventilators today versus 6 months ago, it's a different situation. The different kinds of treatments, our understanding of what this virus really is or isn't. And so really helping the whole system become super expert at the leading edge of managing cases, so we have more confidence that if we were unfortunate enough to get this illness, and while the average death rate is an elderly patient, the average patient is actually younger. So lots of younger people are in the hospitals. It's just they don't necessarily all die. How we make sure we can reassure the population, if you're unfortunate enough to get it, the health system's on top of this and your chances of dying are very low, that is a key piece of all of this. And so for me, test, track, isolate, dream your resort, your healthcare resources to be focused on infectious disease and not, and really make sure your entire health system is at the cutting edge of knowledge of how to case manage and adopt every single piece of insight, most of which is not pharmaceutical, most of which is good clinical understanding developed by physicians on the front line, by the bedside, making sure that is really spread quickly through the system is our next best bet over the next few weeks. And then as we go into next year, you know, we have a good shot at a vaccine of some shape or form. I'm not going to pretend for a minute nobody should expect a vaccine that answers this question comprehensively, but it will help, hopefully. Monoclonal antibodies could help for certain sorts of situations. There is a raft of technologies which are looking like they're going to be, you know, proven or not in the first quarter of next year, and that I think, you know, should significantly strengthen our position.
I'd like to come on to the vaccine in a moment, but Richard, let me try with you. I think a lot of people would listen to what Andrew was saying there, and they'd hear the stuff about isolation, and they would say, okay, what do we know about this disease? We know that 45% of people are asymptomatic. They would point to the fact that a lot of young people don't really get it, but we do know that the younger people who do get it tend to have some form of underlying condition, that kind of thing. Shouldn't we be actually thinking about really targeted, focused dealing with this, rather than cutting a swathe across tens of millions of people?
Yeah, I mean, there's somebody I know who's a professor of public health at the University of Oxford, strongly believes that 40 should be the age cutoff. Everybody above the age of 40 should be working from home and basically take themselves out of society. And everybody under the age of 40 should be going out there and deliberately trying to get infected so that they build up immunity in that age group. And I've been saying to him, well, okay, well, come out and say that in public and let's have a debate about it. But he's too frightened to step out into the spotlight, because that would be a pretty controversial proposal. I think the problem with that is that there is still a significant morbidity, if not mortality, associated with young people getting the virus, getting infected, and that cannot be discounted. The countries that have had low mortality have succeeded because they have suppressed community transmission. Let's look at New Zealand as an example, which has really done incredibly well. What they did was they pressed the prevalence of the virus in the community so that if there was an imported case, you could track and trace that imported case quickly so that it didn't then become a hot spot in the country. The only way that we're going to build that capacity to identify infections and communities is to decentralize our testing system. Now, what we haven't done is we haven't used the fantastic network we have of general practices across the country, which could be the basis for a test, trace, and isolate system. What we've got is the system where you have to drive several miles to get to a testing center, and then it takes 3-4 days in order to get the result. I mean, that's just simply not going to be good enough. If we use the infrastructure of the NHS then I think we could get a testing system in place. I know that's one of the questions. What do we need to do to get the testing system right? We need to bring in the NHS to help.
Okay. Lots, as you say, lots of questions coming in, but I just want to check off a couple of quick things on this area with Amber and Sean. Amber, isn't the problem here what we're basically saying is our government has failed to pick a lane? It didn't decide what we think and just go for it. It's been caught between two stools.
Yes, I think that is part of the problem. The second part of the problem is the government keeps on saying we're the best. Well, you know, this we are the best in the world. We are the best at this. We are the best at that. And then everyone takes it and goes, yeah, no, not really. And I think that is exacerbating the problem. There's no humility in it. I mean, you look from a political point of view at Nicola Sturgeon, who hasn't had a particularly good COVID war either. But the way she gets up and says, we've got it wrong, we've got to do it this way, it feels better, really. It feels her leadership sense feels stronger, really. And I think that makes a big difference. So I think that the way the government is handling it is exacerbated by its determination to say we're doing it all correctly.
And Sean, listening to you, you were talking a lot about what goes on in Asia. A lot of people probably listen to that and go, God, we really can't do that kind of thing, like bracelets and ringing people up every 2 minutes and borderline arresting people. What would you say to that?
Well, we probably can't, because I think if you take Korea, for example, I mean, a lot of your personal data becomes available, and I think that data protection issue comes into play. But we could do so much better if we actually had a localized track and trace system where you had communication between the NHS, but also between local government, local authority, and there was much more localization, local engagement, local control, because that then you can go to where you need to go. So, for example, when in the north, the multi-generational households, younger people were taking the disease back into the households, and it was their older relatives, particularly in the Asian community, who were becoming infected. We saw that. We could see that data from Public Health England. You need to be able to go out and to try to work with those communities through their community leaders. No point having things in languages that aren't first languages blasted across the press. You need to actually be able to go house to house, and that's what they were doing in some of these areas. And I think that's good shoe leather epidemiology and good public health. So we can do other things, because we do have a very good public health system as well as a good general practice system. If they're working together at community level, you could really stay in touch, and you could also then deal with things like long COVID so much more effectively, because that's going up the agenda. Many more people getting the long COVID symptoms, and we don't know how long for.
Richard and Andrew, I was going to ask you about the prospects of a vaccine and pivotal data on that, but it seems actually a more relevant question to me, what prospects are there of having a good test, track and trace system in the UK? Richard, let's start with you first.
Okay, well, thanks. On the vaccine, I am optimistic. There are, I think, 9 candidates that are currently in phase 3 trials. There are about 140 candidates that are in preclinical or early clinical phase studies. The first wave of vaccines will not be the best vaccines. But I think that we'll certainly get phase 3 results through by the end of this year on several of these vaccines, and then it's a case of just to what extent will they work. WHO says that as long as we have a vaccine that is 50% effective, then we'll be in a good first place. Sorry, Craig.
What does phase 3 mean? How robust is it when it?
I apologize. Phase 3 means that you're doing very large scale trials in thousands of patients, and you're not just looking at immunological endpoints, which is what we've been looking at so far, but you actually look at whether the vaccine can prevent infection or alter the course of the disease. As I say, we've got 9 of those in place.
And Andrew, when we were talking before this call, you said there's a lot of caveats about vaccines when they come through and about whether or not that takes us out of the woods or not. Can you just explain that?
Yeah, so first of all, I completely agree with everything Richard just said. We should see the first phase 3 results before the end of the year, or right around the turn of the year, I suspect. few things just to note, though. Listen, first of all, it's a miracle that there are 9 vaccines in advanced trials. I mean, you know, if you'd gone back in February and said that was going to happen, you'd say not a chance. I mean, normally that would take 10 years to get to that. So really, that's phenomenal. The fact that of those 9, you've got a variety of different technologies or vectors or approaches to build the vaccine, it's really positive. So if you were thinking about an investment portfolio, it's quite attractive because you've got bets on a number of different types of vaccines. So that gives you a diversified risk, which is also terrific. The thing everybody just needs to remember is the purpose of phase 3 trials is to basically find bad news, right? So yes, you want to know whether it works. You also want to know if it has any adverse events. And you know, 2 of the leading vaccines right now are on pause because they have had events occur. Nobody knows how material that's going to be, but it has obviously caused a bit of a delay. And so you should fully anticipate more of that kind of thing. It doesn't mean that it's game over. It means that we're discovering things which have to be addressed and risks have to be ruled out. Remember, unlike drugs, you give vaccines to otherwise healthy people. So you better be sure that you're not causing new problems when you do that, because the patient on the day you vaccinate them is not sick. And so you have your burden of evidence around safety has to be super high. So we're going to see those sorts of issues. We're already delayed from the most optimistic statements that were being made back in the spring. And I think you will continue to see little bits of delay here and there. Second thing I would say, making vaccines at scale is a challenging engineering and technical problem. And going from lab to giant volumes is not a simple process. And tech transfer in vaccines, because many vaccines have biological processes inside their manufacturing technologies, those are not easy things to transfer from factory to factory. So I would simply say we need to go into that phase, meaning we have a vaccine that works. Can we now have 1 billion doses or 2 billion doses or 5 billion doses? But we've got to be a little humility around that. That can be difficult to do. And I just to ground you on that, I ran the biggest vaccine company in the world for 10 years. I don't think anybody in the world has ever made 1 billion doses of a single vaccine, with the exception of oral polio, ever. And so when we talk about we're going to have a new vaccine and we're going to make billions and billions of billions. And again, just to reinforce that point, if you take the developing world vaccine manufacturers, so the Indians, the Indonesians, which have historically manufactured large volumes, the total annual output of that entire industry is 3.5 billion doses of all vaccines. And so what you're talking about here now is taking breakthrough technology developed at light speed and taking it to a level of industrial scale which has never been achieved in anything ever. Now, can that be done? It can be done. But don't expect it not to have a few delays on the way. I mean, that you are looking at the industrial complex really having to do the most extraordinary things to bring this to life, which they are doing. And the delivery of the vaccine companies, the universities, the health systems, the governments has been quite extraordinary. But this is a huge lift. So I want you to be optimistic, but I want you to be realistic about timing.
Just quickly, what would a minimum amount of time be to do that, do you think? I know it's difficult, but give us a rough
idea. I think what you could end up with is, let's play your probabilities. You have 9 vaccines. Let's imagine of the 9, I'm making this up, 2 achieve a kind of threshold level of performance, at least, in the next 6. So by the middle of next year, let's assume we had 2 who make it from an efficacy safety point of view. My guess is that you could have phases where you have millions of doses coming on stream relatively quickly. But to get to hundreds of millions, billions of doses, that will take, you know, a year or more to get to that kind of scale of output, you know, with the normal risks associated. And if there is only 1 or 2 vaccines, then the whole world is going to want them. So how we then manage to avoid a kind of Lord of the Flies collapse of multilateral, you know, engagement is super critical, which is exactly what we're focused on right now at WHO. And one of the things that is really positive out of all of this, and the UK have been really central to it, we've now got something like 190 countries, including some of the richest in the world, including the poorest in the world, come together in a joint coalition to fund and procure vaccines globally. And I know this conversation's been a lot about the UK, but ultimately, it's not much point fixing coronavirus in the UK if everybody else in the world still has it. You still can't go anywhere. Mm. You still can't sell anything to anybody. So you've got to deal with this on a global, multilateral basis. And vaccines have to really be thought through that lens. So how those scarce resources, there won't be many of them. Initially, there won't be tons of doses available. How those get allocated to give the best prospect of resolving both the disease and the economic stress the whole world is feeling, that's the next wave of stuff that has to really be thought through. And just really finally, Craig, just to your point on diagnostics, I would ask that government put as much energy into funding innovation of diagnostics as they have on vaccines. So we should, you know, it's amazing to me that we don't have something like a pregnancy test where literally I can have the result 2 minutes after I put my saliva on the test and know that it's correct. That is something, money could solve that scientific problem. You put enough money into that question, you will answer that question.
Okay, that's fascinating. Look, we've got about 12 minutes left and lots of questions have come through. So what I'm going to do is try and race through them as quickly as possible if we can. Sean, Daniel Summerfield's asking, what is the significance of the apparent divergence between what Sage advised, such as introducing a circuit breaker and closing pubs and restaurants, and what the government ultimately decided to do with its three-tier system?
Divergence. Well, a circuit breaker would close everybody down for a short period of time. Such as the steps that I think have been taken in Northern Ireland today. They would close pubs, they would circuit breakers to decrease socialising. So schools close, university students are taught online, and we basically all stay at home to bring the R rate down below one. And if the R rate can come down below the reproductive rate that's passing, once it goes above one, the disease is spreading in the community. Once the R rate is lower, if you can do that, then the idea is you can then bring in a track and trace system that, because you have fewer cases after that, and you can stay on top of the spread, isolate the spread, try and stop community spread, try and actually get the testing and the isolation in place. So what the government is proposing are sort of a step towards that. And so it's a three-tier approach, and you've got the medium tier where it's rule of six, it's non-pharmaceutical interventions, it's early closure of pubs. So that's a sort of step towards it. The high and then high, and in the very high, there's no household mixing, basically stay at home, but you can still work, schools stay open. So it steps towards a circuit breaker. So it's not the whole thing. And because it's not the whole thing, and that's playing in the economic reasons, because if you do a circuit breaker, you could have much more profound, maybe just short-lived impact on the economy, on the local economy. You know, you take away income from restaurant owners for 2 to 3 weeks. I think one of the questions that keeps coming back again is, if you did that, would you need to do it more than once? Or would you need to do it sequentially once the rates started to rise again? And in a way, the recommendation was given on September the 21st. You know, we're several weeks past that now, and the rates have continued to go up exponentially. So if you're going to do a circuit breaker, you need to do it very quickly. And so that's why people were suggesting half term, a 2 week half term, everybody stay home at half term because your schools are closing anyway. Make it as painless as possible, because it's painful and it will have an economic impact. But the longer term health impact would be the gain. And of course, health and wealth are so interrelated. It's very difficult to talk about one or the other. But it is a decision that will require the public to accept the decision. And we've seen with compliance and students, you have to get compliance from the people that the measures are aimed at.
And Amber, there's a lot of people saying on the Q&A, like the critical mass of thinking seems to be coalescing around this idea of having a circuit breaker the opposition is saying that, the scientific and the health community seems to be saying that. What do you think the chances of this government actually just buckling on that?
I don't think it will. I think that it'll look very much like a national circuit break when it's the higher level is imposed everywhere. I think it's difficult for Boris to do a U-turn of that scale. But can I just ask Sian, perhaps Richard? I don't know. I don't quite understand the point of a 2-week circuit break when you go straight back to where you were. If you haven't improved the track and trace, what does it achieve apart from obviously some people not dying?
Let me, Richard, ask you this question from Kyne Levinson, which is essentially the same thing, which is how do you bring a country out of these measures in the long term? If you suppress a virus, don't you just run the risk of it coming back again and again, Richard?
So it's a great question. You have the lockdown. That immediately cuts the lines of viral transmission. So there's no virus that's going from person to person any longer. That brings the R below 1. At that point, you've stopped the infection dead in its tracks. After that 2 to 3 week period, the idea is that you can then come out of lockdown, and if you stick to the rules, which is the physical distancing, mask wearing, and so on and so forth, then you limit the ability of what virus is left in the community to spread. So at that point, as long as we stick by those rules, then you've got every possibility of turning off community transmission, and then you will get occasional clusters that break out, but it's the community transmission that you've ended. I would remind you, I know that we did this for the very best of reasons, the eat out to help out idea, but remember what it was like on August bank holiday. Everybody was out, the sun was shining, we were back to normal, nobody was physical distancing, nobody was wearing a mask, and the community transmission just exploded at the end of August, early September. And so I'm afraid we did get on top of it with our lockdown in March and April and May, but then we let it come back. So we need to learn the lesson of that. A short lockdown will work, I absolutely guarantee it, because it worked earlier in the year, and then we have to stick with the rules.
And Andrew, lots of questions coming in around this kind of thing about quite how tough those things need to be. So for example, Catherine Hallahan is asking what measures should exist at our airports. You were mentioning Australia, for example. What do you think?
Well, I think if we're going to have give ourselves a chance to open up airports, we need much more rigorous testing on either on departure and on arrival, and then essentially isolation between the results of the test. I mean, there really isn't much point in testing somebody in Terminal 5 arrivals hall, letting them wander down to Starbucks on the King's Road, do whatever they're going to do, and then ring them up 4 days later and say, sorry, you're positive. So, you know, you've got to have a kind of an approach to managing that. And obviously that is super disruptive for the individual. I completely understand that. But what we have to trade off here is, can we assert more measures, which yes, are disruptive for individuals who are representing a potential vector, as a way to free up essentially the whole population and economy? And I think that's what this all boils down to. Do you suppress every single activity in the economy, as we had to do back in the spring, or can you adopt more assertive, restrictive behaviors around some very specific situations which we know are vectors, and you can close them down? Now, I'm with Richard. And as I said earlier, we are where we are. So to try and get a grip of where we are now, just with doing these very targeted measures like the airport, is pointless, because it's already across the population. You probably do have to do something like Richard's talking about to get us back to a kind of a reasonably stable situation. But then I would say, when you come out of that, you need to have a more assertive approach to airports. You have to have more assertive approach to following up test, track and trace. all of that stuff. Otherwise, we're going to be straight back. Otherwise, Amber's right. 2 months from now, we'll be back in the same hole. There has to be a different dynamic after you've brought the thing back down under control. And you're going to be in that position until, you know, either something I think is highly unlikely, the virus burns out, which I can't see any evidence of at all, or we have some kind of vaccine which gives us the beginnings of getting a grip of it.
So we're coming to the end of the call. So I'm just going to ask one question of all of you, and I'd appreciate it if you just took 30 seconds each, no more than that, a couple of sentences each on it. The question that just keeps coming back, particularly after what we've said about the vaccine and how long it's going to take to reach scale and that kind of thing, is aren't we just going to have to learn to live with it? And if we are learning to live with it, does that mean particularly tough restrictions and we just need to swallow that? Is that what we're saying? Richard, I'm going to start with you.
Yes, we do have to learn to live with it. We're renegotiating our relationship with this virus, and the goal is peaceful coexistence. And we are going to have to change our behaviors. We are going to, you know, if you travel to China or Japan, it was very it's very common to see people wearing masks in the street. That's going to become our new norm for the time being. And we're just going to have to accept that.
Andrew, you're running a massive business. That means that businesses are also going to have to get used to the economies of the world not necessarily working in the ways that they used to for quite a while to come.
Yes. Yes, and I think it's stimulating the most incredible innovation inside companies. So if you look, you know, whether you're talking about super small companies who used to do everything face to face but have now gone online, you've seen a rapid acceleration. If I look in my company in the US, you know, in the space of 3 months, I think we went from something like 1,000 virtual doctor visits a month to something like 400,000. Gigantic expansion of digital medicine. And actually, that's created greater access for patients to be able to visit with their doctors more quickly on lots of situations. So I listen, of course, it's going to be different. Is it going to be worse? Not necessarily. I mean, you know, maybe this kind of pressure and stimulation which really drives changes. Even the way in which we've worked together to move the vaccines forward. You know, there are ways of working we've discovered which we don't want to lose after this pandemic. You know, these are good things. So I think industries look at this as a stimulus for innovation.
John, it sounds like you think things are going to have to get tighter and tougher for some time to come. A couple of sentences.
Yes, I think the virus is here. We need to learn to live with it. We need to respond. We need to recognize that we are going to do things differently. We're going to work differently. We're going to visit differently. We're not going to travel in the same way. Many things will change in our lives. But as the others have said, maybe some of these changes are for the better. And, you know, we'll find a new equilibrium. But we need to make sure that we see the virus as an important factor in protecting the health of our populations and our communities.
Amber, is that going to be acceptable to a Treasury which is worrying to the degree it is, and a Prime Minister who's worried about backbenchers who don't like it?
I think it's the only thing we can do. I mean, we've heard several times today, we are where we are. We've got to live with the reality that we've got. I do feel, unfortunately, that this government is not able to deliver on the sort of tight restrictions that would allow us to keep it under, keep the virus properly suppressed. So I can't see the point of the 2 week lockdown, because I don't think it would achieve what other countries have been able to achieve. I think we are going to, as Richard said, going to learn to live with it.
Well, thank you to what's been an amazing panel. I thought it was absolutely fascinating. I've learned a huge amount. And we can't give a round of applause, but we will be giving you a virtual standing ovation as we usually do. So thank you, Andrew Whitty, Richard Horton, Sean Griffiths, and Amber Rudd. Thank you so much. You've been brilliant. It's not necessarily been the most optimistic of conversations, but it's certainly been very relieving. Thank you very much.